Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto? I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
It's the Maryland Film Festival edition of Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, film critic for The Washington Post. The festival opens virtually on May 19th as theaters in the area gradually begin to open for in-person screenings. We'll have a preview and a few suggestions for streaming before the festival begins. Plus, J. Wynn Russett reviews Berta Berta, a new virtual production at the Everyman Theater. I'm Tom Hall. The news is next. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for Midday. Today, it's the Midday Maryland Film Festival edition of Midday at the Movies. The film festival runs from May 19th to the 27th, and once again, it will be an all-virtual affair, although people who are holding all-access passes will be invited to a few in-person screenings. So the Parkway Theater does remain closed at the moment. Some local theaters are beginning to reemerge from the pandemic hiatus. The Regal Theaters in Hunt Valley and Columbia have announced that they are reopening today. The Charles Theater is open for a limited number of screenings. The Senator Theater on York Road will reopen later this month. The Landmark Theater in downtown Baltimore is undergoing a renovation before reopening as Harbor East Cinemas. They're going to have reduced capacity. They're redoing the whole joint down there. And they're going to have even plans for live performances. Comedy acts, magic acts, small bands are going to play, as well as movies down at the new Harbor East Cinemas, which will open sometime in the next few weeks. We are joined again today here on Zoom by our good friend Anne Hornaday. She's a film critic for the Washington Post and the author of the best-selling Moviegoer's Guide, Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Hey, Anne, how you doing?
Hello, Tom. Fine, thank you.
And also with us on Zoom is our good friend Jed Dietz. He is the founding father of the Maryland Film Festival. Hey, Jed, good to talk to you.
Hey, Tom, good to talk to you.
So, Jed, the Maryland Film Festival has announced a very big lineup. There's 104 movies, 33 different programs. It's just going to be virtual. It was virtual for most folks. It was virtual last year. I mean, how do you think it worked last year when it was, you know, when you were unable to have folks be in person? And did you and the board of the Maryland Film Festival, do you think you learned things about how last year's festival went that have informed what you're going to do this year?
Yes, for sure. I think the overall feeling about all these virtual festivals is that you really miss being there in person. The trade-off is obvious, which is really the world gets to see the films, and there's more flexibility depending on the restrictions around the films for all viewers. So it's a mixed blessing. I think, you know, for sure, streaming virtual screenings will continue with us. But I'm personally, and I think I speak for lots of people, looking forward to the day when film festivals come back. This year, Sundance, you know, was all virtual. And there were things there I loved. It's exciting launch of a lot of new talent, but not being there is a very different experience, and seeing films on your laptop is a very different experience.
And Anne, I've been to your house a bunch of times, but I don't recall your television. do you have a television that's like, you know, some people, they have TVs that are the size of Rhode Island. I mean, it's like,
yes.
You know, and you say this is a television in somebody's living room, you know, or family room. So it's all it's there are some movie theaters you go to, and the smaller ones, the screens are not super ginormous. I mean, when you watch movies at your house, are you seeing them on a fairly big screen, or are you watching them on your laptop to review them?
Well, since you have been to my house, then you know I don't have we don't have enough wall space in our little duplex to accommodate those huge mega big big home screens. So I have a pretty big screen that I'm comfortable watching things on, thinking that, well, it's not ideal, but it's as big as I can, reasonably get into my house and have a reasonable kind of viewing distance. But in all, and I try to watch as many things as I can in that way. But there are instances when, yes, Tom, I do have to watch things on my laptop. And it just, it breaks my heart for the filmmakers who I know didn't make these movies in order to be seen on a laptop. On the other hand, I think especially this, the new generation, the younger generation coming up, that's actually kind of what they do expect. So, it's not as aesthetically heartbreaking as seeing like an Andrei Tarkovsky film, on your watch. But I do, when at all possible, I really do want to try to see it. I want to try to at least approximate what the artist was intending, which is just that big screen immersive experience. Yeah.
Sure. Go ahead, Jed.
Just one difference that has emerged recently is, and then it was sort of led, and I don't mean to tag him with it because there were others who thought like this, but Bill Maher did a rant about how down the Oscars were this year. And I don't mean in ratings, which they also were, but he just thought all the nominations were, Nomadland and The Father and all these things were these grim subjects. And I think it's really because he hasn't been able to see them in movie theaters. Because I think when you're with other people and watching even very tough movies, as you come out of the theater, there's some discussion that goes on, not maybe even in your group, but a group near you or something. And then you're talking to people afterwards, just as a natural thing. And I think all that has been shrunk and atomized sort of. And so I think it leaves a completely different impression about a movie's impact. It's something, I mean, I just have anecdotal.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Jed. And Anne, when you're at a film festival, that kind of buzz, that kind of chit-chat after the movies, I would imagine is hugely important. I mean, because there's a mix of people who are, real film auteurs. There's the directors themselves, the actors, the producers, the critics like yourself, and then, normal people, as we call everyone else. I mean, because a buzz for a movie needs people talking about it.
It needs an actual physical audible buzz. And that's true. And I did, as excellent as I think the Maryland Film Festival and Toronto and AFI Docs and AFI Fest and Sundance, they all did a great job with their virtual festivals this past year. I was so impressed with all of the interfaces, and I saw wonderful films at all of those festivals. There was especially the big seller out of Sundance was this charming movie called Coda, which we will all be talking about in August, but it's just that crowd pleaser movie. It's the one that makes you laugh. It's the one that makes you cry. I would say, Summer of Soul, Questlove's documentary, which is coming out this summer, is another one where it's so exhilarating and you want to be in that room levitating, because that's the feeling you get when you're in these movies. It's like the audience, you can just feel it ripple through, and then you're all kind of transported. And that feeling was missing when we were all watching it at home in our living rooms. And I totally agree with Jed about the, that unfair, I think, sort of diss of this year's Oscars movies is because they were really good movies. I mean, these were exhilarating in terms of the craft, yes, they were serious, but they were such well-made films that people, they would have been buzzing about them and talking about them if they had seen them all together.
And Jed, of course, you have filmmakers. I mean, when you started the festival some years ago, part of the big push was to be able to have filmmakers talk to each other and talk to directors and talk to other directors and talk to producers, et cetera. I mean, to have the film business people. You had all these panels and these sessions that were just for filmmakers and not for the general public. Can they do anything approximating that in an online format?
No, they can't approximate that. We will do Q&As with filmmakers after the virtual screenings, as we did last year, and Sundance did that very well. And again, you know, you get the advantage that then that Q&A, is available for more days, so it's not just that one screening. That doesn't duplicate what Anne's talking about, that feeling in the room. Mm-hmm. And I would say to come out of a screening of The Father, this Anthony Hopkins movie about dementia. So, you know, not a laugh riot subject, but it's totally fascinating. And there is, in fact, humor mm-hmm. in it. And I think and the wonder of his acting and the production design that we've talked about on this show before that is really sensational. Both those things are sensational. The whole cast is great, but I mean, he's the center of it. And, you know, to feel that happen with the crowd during the movie and also as you're leaving, there isn't a way to duplicate that in your mm-hmm. own home.
And listeners, I would love to hear from you. If you are a normal, usual, regular attender of the Maryland Film Festival, will you be tuning in virtually this year? Did you tune in virtually last year? What was your experience? What was your impression? What are you looking forward to this year? Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. To email us, we're at midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So, Anne, are there filmmakers or particular films that you've heard a little bit about or, subject areas you think are interesting that filmmakers are choosing to explore at this year's festival as you glance at the offerings that are going to be available starting May 19th?
Well, I'm interested in, yes, I mean, the good news, sort of the bad news for our conversation today is that I haven't seen any of these films. And the good news is I haven't seen any of these films.
Yeah, right. Right. Exactly. So finally, something to look forward to. Right.
No, really, truly. I'm really looking forward. I'm always looking forward to the opening night shorts because that's become the most cherished, to me, one of the most cherished, if not the most cherished traditions of the Maryland Film Festival. And the closing night film, Women as Losers, I've read about a little bit about it, and that sounds incredibly intriguing. I was really gratified to see, and this is sort of a little bit of a trendlet this past year with I know Toronto did this too, because so many people are accessing from home, festivals have taken care to make sure that they include a lot of family programming. And so there's a family strand at Maryland this year. And I think there's some interesting work being done in that part of the film ecosystem that I'm kind of a champion for, because I feel like family is often dismissed as being sappy or saccharine or kind of, not edgy enough. And it's like, no, actually, there's some really good work being done in that space. And mm-hmm. I would also posit the degree of difficulty is harder because they don't have those crutches of graphic violence and vulgarity and cool, whatever makes a movie quote unquote cool. They don't have that in their language, their toolbox. So I'm always interested to see what people are doing in that part of the schedule.
Yeah, there's four movies. One's called Beans. It's directed by Tracy Deer. Another, Lily Topples the World. It's directed by Jeremy Workman. There's one called Mom and M by Jenna Birchick. And Teen Dreams, which has a bunch of different directors. That's part of the short film program. So there are some family offerings. Jed, how about you? When you glance at the offerings, I mean, obviously you haven't seen very many or maybe any at all, like Anne, because none of us have. But what stands out to you as things that you're really looking forward to? And what would you recommend to those folks who, get their film festival program every year and meticulously go through and say, this is what I'm going to do at this time, and this is what I'm going to do at that time?
Yeah, so I'll start by underscoring one of the ones that you mentioned, Lily Topples the World, which is about this 21-year-old, I've seen a big chunk of this one, 21-year-old who has learned to do dominoes, as in setting them up and then knocking them over, at a scale you cannot believe, like 700,000 dominoes she will do in a setup. And this is all done by hand. So when she's doing these things, sometimes she gets a third of the way through and one domino goes and they all go over. And she has to scrap that or start over. I mean, she's a real phenomenon, and the film is going to be fun, I think. Not having seen the whole thing, but it's going to be fun for anybody. But there's some locally connected things and some alums of the festival I would point out. The Strawberry Mansion, the Albert Burney, Kentucker Audley picture, which was at Sundance, it is great. And Albert, by the way, is also has done some animation for another film called We're All Going to the World's Fair, which coincidentally was also at Sundance by a first-time filmmaker, writer, director named Jane Schoenbrunn. And he did some animation for that. She also, Jane Schoenbrunn, had done a piece of collective filmmaking called Collective Unconscious that was in the Maryland Film Festival maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So We're All Going to the World's Fair, I'd be interested, you know, I'm very much on my list to see. Mm-hmm. There's an international film called Trees of Peace that I was interested in because one of our programming team who's worked with us for a long time, Eric Cotton, wrote up in a very passionate and interesting way the description on the website. So that's on my list. There's a documentary called No Ordinary Man, which is about a jazz performer, Billy Tipton. It was in sort of hiding from a gender standpoint in an era when gender confusion couldn't even be thought about. That's interesting to me. One last one I'd mention is Theo Anthony, who did the Rat film that was really got a lot of play all around the world, but was a sensation here, and we had wonderful, wonderful screenings of it. It has a new film called All Light Everywhere. So those are just a handful. There are a bunch of others, but those are a handful ones that I'm really interested in.
And one of the ones you mentioned, Strawberry Mansion, has music by Dan Deacon, Baltimore's own, so that'll be interesting to see. By the way, this just in, the Baltimore Sun reporting within the last couple of minutes that Artscape has been canceled this year because of COVID-19 concerns, so we'll have more on that moving forward. We're going to take a little break. Ann Hornaday is a film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. We will have more of Midday at the Movies with Ann and Jed, and we want to hear what you are checking out these days, whether you're checking them out in theaters, whether you plan to go to the Maryland Film Festival, what you're streaming at home. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @midday_wipr. And one quick note about a concert that's coming up on Mother's Day Sunday. The famed Morgan State University Choir will present a virtual show Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. So through the magic of Zoom and skilled editing, Dr. Eric Conway has been able to put together a wonderful show featuring singers who've been working under the weirdest and worst conditions that any musician can imagine. I've heard some of their tracks, and somehow they managed to sound great. It still is the Morgan Choir. So come to wipr.org/midday, and we'll shoot you a link for this free event. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WIPR.
Hi, I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Hala Vinsay.
In the coming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll be sharing 5 advantages of health savings accounts and also some key findings from a new report on the rapidly evolving workplace. You can find the Clear Path, your Roadmap for Life podcast on WYPR's website and mobile app, wherever you get your podcasts, and at transamericainstitute.org.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, looking ahead to Monday's program, a conversation about economic development and challenges that Baltimore and other American cities are facing. Mac McComas is a senior program manager at the Johns Hopkins 21st Century Cities Initiative, and he's the co-author of a new book called Unlocking the Potential of Post-Industrial Cities. We'll talk to Mac about that. We'll also talk to Baltimore Business Journal Associate Editor Ethan McLeod about the development scene here in Baltimore as we come out of the pandemic. And plus, Leatrice Gant of Baltimore Ceasefire 365 will join me to discuss the group's activities over this coming Mother's Day and Baltimore Ceasefire weekend. So that's coming up Monday here on Midday, and on the way a little later today, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join us with her latest review. She'll tell us about a show called Berta Berta at the Everyman Theater. And if you have just joined us today, it's the Maryland Film Festival edition of Midday at the Movies. The festival runs virtually from May 19th through the 27th. If you hold an all-access pass, chances are very good that there will be a couple of in-person screenings at the Parkway Theater. More information about that when you check them out online. Washington Post film critic Ann Hornaday and Maryland Film Festival founding director Jed Dietz are with us. We'd love to hear what you're watching these days, streaming or otherwise. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday at WIPR.org. Our Twitter handle is at midday WIPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, dozens of people do. I can't help but remind you of that. It's a huge, huge crowd. You could fit them right in your kitchen. It's at Tom Hall, WIPR. So let's talk about a couple of movies that aren't at the film festival, but they're out and about or going to be out and about soon. Let's listen to a clip of a movie called The Human Factor. Let's listen first, and then we'll talk about it on the other side.
It was history in the making. The idea of breaking through that taboo was just unbelievable.
And I can see that something changes in the relationship.
They had moved from being adversaries to partners in peace.
We say to you today, in a loud and a clear voice, enough of blood and tears. Enough!
When I look back now, we saw the world the way we wanted it to be. We did not see the world the way it was.
So, Anne, this is a behind-the-scenes look at efforts by the United States to get peace in the Middle East. What did you think of this one?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of this film. I'm a huge fan of the filmmaker. It's a guy named Dora Murray who did an absolutely fantastic movie a few years ago called The Gatekeepers about Shin Bet, the Israeli secret service, or not secret, the Israeli intelligence service. And he interviewed all the past heads of that agency to get these incredibly candid recollections and analyses of Israeli policy toward the Palestinians. It was just it was a real breakthrough film. And he's done the very same thing here. He's talking to six of the most crucial negotiators who were in these different chapters of the peace process throughout administrations. These are people like Dennis Ross and Robert Malley and Martin Indyk. A lot of NPR listeners, I'm sure, know those names. And so they're giving this kind of institutional history from their perches, kind of behind the scenes, in varying degrees of self-awareness. Aaron David Miller, to me, was the most fascinating of this team in terms of really being able to kind of be brutally honest about their own blind spots and failures. But Dror has just perfected this kind of movie. And I know Jed has a lot to say, too, but one of the things that really impressed me is this is the kind of thing that often a filmmaker will feel the need to give a primer in the history, right? And make sure viewers know exactly. And Dror doesn't do that. He just puts us right in to the middle of things and kind of lets the movie just be very narrowly focused on this one aspect of the history, which there were moments when I would have liked a little bit more context, or I felt like I wanted to pipe in and say, well, what about the lobbyists and what about, but he just is, he's on this very single-minded mission in this film. And I really admire that. I think he does a great job.
Yeah. And Jed, the Sony Pictures has decided to release this in theaters. So as far as I'm told, it's not streaming. Interesting decision there. What's your take?
And I think it will stream, but this is another example. I got to see it streaming, but I would love to see this in a movie theater. And it's funny because there, you know, it's not like this is a big action film. I mean, it's a in format. It's
yeah, it's an interesting decision.
Yeah,
because it's a very, doc. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, and a straightforward doc based on archival photos and you know a bunch of interviews, as Anne pointed out, super extensive interviews. Dror's first cut of this film was 36 hours, and that wasn't really viable.
So, sorry, it's my bowling night. I can't make it.
And he still claims that every minute of that was interesting to him. And he said he started, I think he, for some reason, was in Kissinger's office when Dennis Ross and Kissinger were sort of debating the nuclear deal with Iran. So sort of in that era, 7 or 8 years ago. And it just dawned on him. He said this was like being inside something, which of course I, as a filmmaker, don't get to do very often. And I'd like to show that process. And that sort of, he talked to Dennis Ross a little bit coming out of the office, and that got him interested in this whole process, because Dennis sort of unloaded on him about this time period that Anne described, you know, when the Palestinians and the Israelis were not talking to each other in any way. They wouldn't recognize each other's existence, let alone talk to each other. Oslo had happened. There was this idea about it. It was all very back channel. And to this day, people are still sort of guessing how that happened. And then, you know, the Bush administration, H.W. Bush, the first Bush administration under James Baker, went to work on this. And the minute detail that Dror catches, and I'm sure this is what, you know, fascinated him to build a film of 36 hours, but you will see this human factor. He originally called the film The Negotiator, and he decided this thing took over, which is this human factor and how important it is for the world. And you know, you'll see a little scene where Yitzhak Rabin, who was in the clip you used, you know, puts his hand on Arafat's back, or the other way around, Arafat puts his hand on Rabin's back, and you sort of gasp. I mean, it is so, the idea that the leader of the Palestinians would behave like this, or you know, a session at Camp David, and they and they come so close. It's a totally riveting, fascinating
film.
All right,
it's called The Human Factor. Let's talk about another one. This is available on Amazon Prime. It's called Quo Vadis Aida. Here's a little clip.
Tanks are getting closer and closer by the hour.
We are doing everything we can. Aircraft are on standby and ready to launch an attack on all positions held by the Republika Srpska Army.
What will happen if the planes don't come?
They will come. They will come.
So we're in Bosnia, July 1995, Aida is a translator for the UN in Srebrenica, and the Serbian army takes over the town. So, Anne, what do you think?
Oh, I was blown away by this movie. It was actually one of the nominees for Best International Feature this year, deservedly so. It's an intense minute by minute. It almost unfolds in real time. It reminded me so much of the movie Son of Saul that came out a few years ago, which follows this one character through a concentration camp as he is on this very, very personal, intimate mission.
Yeah.
And Aida is a very similar character. She just threads us through this desperate and growingly desperate situation that very rarely leaves this one area, you know, the UN area where a bunch of refugees came. There's like little forays out into Srebrenica where we eavesdrop, speaking of human factor, you know, eavesdrop on very similar tense negotiations between diplomats and military leaders. But no, it's just a riveting, beautifully made film by Yasmin Lisbanich from her own play. It's just a terrific piece of filmmaking and a absolutely riveting central performance from Jasna Dricic, the lead actress. She's just fantastic.
Yeah. All right, so that's on Amazon. It's called Quo Vadis Aida. And Jed, let me ask you about another one called About Endlessness. This is a movie by the director Roy Anderson. Again, this one's available on Amazon Prime and Apple TV and a couple of other streaming services. What do you think about Endlessness?
Oh, I was so enchanted by this movie. And I didn't know this filmmaker's work, Roy Anderson. He was in his 70s now until I read Anne's review of this movie. And I immediately wanted to go see it. And I will tell you, everybody that I've talked to, and I've been chatting about it quite a bit, advocating for this movie, when I say the title, people burst out laughing. They say, you know, well, what's it about? There's really no plot.
It's baked into the cake, isn't it? It's called. It's about endlessness. Yeah,
right. And despair, by the way, just in case you're.
Is that included in the price of the ticket? What a bargain! You get endlessness and despair. Yeah, terrific.
But so it's a collection of these little scenes that this guy shoots in his studio, I think below where he lives. And every scene opens and it looks like a photograph, a beautiful little photograph. Sometimes there's, you know, the first one is a couple overlooking a city. So there might be some expanse to it. Maybe not. Maybe it's just it's a room. And the scene that then evolves, and some of them connect, some of them don't, and the music and stuff, and they're sometimes very humorous. They're totally surprising in ways that it's very hard to describe, but right. I love seeing it in any way I could get to it, but I wish I could. As soon as it hits a movie theater, I'm going to run to a movie theater.
There you go. Maybe it's the perfect COVID movie, you know, because talking about endlessness and despair. You know, I'm reminded of Saturday Night Live. You know, it's a floor wax and a dessert topping. All right, so let's go. Anne, I want you to tell us about this on the other side of this clip we were talking before about family movies. This is David Oyelowo directing a movie now, not starring in it. It's called The Waterman. Let's take a listen.
The Waterman is real. Legend has it that he's still living up by the lake, searching the waters and the woods for his wife, so he could bring her back from the dead.
I always thought the Waterman was just something grown-ups told kids to keep him from sneaking off into the woods. No one knows where to find him. No one except me.
The note I saw in this book says that he's immortal. I need to know more about it.
Got any money?
Yes, but I'm still gonna need money to buy supplies.
Supplies for what?
I'm going to find the Waterman.
So, Anne, what do you think? How does Mr. Oyelowo do in his directorial debut?
Oh, I think he does beautifully well. And this is one of those movies I saw at Virtual Toronto last year, and that was a part of their family strand. And I was really taken with it because it reminded me of, the first reference would be Steven Spielberg, you know, those old, the E.T. era Amblin, Steven Spielberg, where he was making movies that were centered around children, but were not childish. You know, they were having kind of supernatural adventures, but they were grounded kind of in the sadnesses and losses and tensions of real life. And he didn't shy away from that. And I feel like over the ensuing years, a lot of these kinds of quote unquote family movies have become subsumed either under Marvel, DC, you know, not so much DC, but like the comic book movies or the Pixar movies. And we've really lost these kind of charming one-off movies that aren't, they're not babyish. They deal with real people, but they also have a little touch of magic to them. And it's something that maybe, you know, a family can sit down with their 10-year-old and up. I wouldn't necessarily recommend this for little kids, if only just because they might not understand what's going on. And there are some sort of mildly frightening, perilous things, because kids kind of like that stuff. And that's one of the things we go to the movies for. And I just feel like Oyelowo, the movie it reminded me the most of was a wonderful film called Holes that was based on a kid's novel. It starred a young Shia LaBeouf. It was just, again, a great example of a family film that isn't condescending. It's not patronizing. It's just beautifully made, done with a lot of good taste, and just trying to kind of resuscitate this lost form that I think Hollywood should really try to bring back.
And we just got a minute left, so let me mention a couple of emails. Terry emails and says, I saw Strawberry Mansion when it premiered at Sundance earlier this year. It was a fantastical journey of a movie, fun narrative concept and execution, and beautifully shot local locations. And he asks, are there any other locally based films in the Maryland Film Festival this year? And Terry, the answer to that is a definitive yes. So go to the website and check it out. Teresa emails that because her Wi-Fi is so rotten in her part of the city, she's not going to be able to get a ticket to the film festival because she just doesn't think she can stream the video. So again, this the varying quality of Wi-Fi from place to place here in the city, something that certainly does need to be addressed. So thanks to everybody for tuning in. Thanks to Ann Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post and the author of the best-selling Film Goer's Guide, Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies, and Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Appreciate it, you guys. We'll see you next month. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
And coming up next, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us with her review of the new virtual production from Baltimore's Everyman Theater. And the 36th annual Fallen Heroes Day observance will be live streamed at 1:00 today in just about 16 minutes or so on the Delaney Valley Memorial Gardens Facebook page. And we've got a link to it on our website. Only family members of those being honored this year will be attending the ceremony in person. This is an annual event that honors police officers, firefighters, and emergency medical rescue personnel who have died in the line of duty. The ceremony could not be held last year because of COVID, so today officials will honor first responders who have died during the last 2 years. They are Police Officer Kyle David Olinger of Montgomery County, Firefighter Michael Mike Powers of the Liberty Town Volunteer Fire Department in Frederick, Assistant Engineer Otis Isaacs Jr. of the Northeast Fire Company, Paramedic Jeffrey Lee Jeff Schaefer of the Tawnytown Volunteer Fire Company in Carroll County, Corporal Christine Peters of the Greenbelt Police Department in Prince George's County, and additionally, two first responders who died before the Fallen Heroes Day was established will also be honored. Firefighter Alexander C. Johnson of Annapolis and Police Officer Milton I. Spell of the Baltimore City Police Department. Corporal Keith Heacock of the Delmar Police Department died in the line of duty last week. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.